SIS 301, Spring Semester 2009. Welcome to Lecturelet number 6, in which we are going to tackle the really heavy stuff, Immanuel Kant. Also one of the first people that we've read who actually talks specifically about international relations as a discrete object of inquiry or as a discrete empirical environment. Now, Thucydides did that, but we've only had sporadic references to international relations with the folks that we've read since Thucydides, and that is something that I think is fairly significant. In fact, at this point, I want to take a couple of minutes before I talk about Kant in particular and give you some context for trying to figure out what's going on within what's actually a very complicated argument in the Perpetual Peace essay. And it's too bad, because what gets taken out of the Perpetual Peace essay is a really strange, misleading couple of isolated quotations. It actually turns out to be a much more complicated argument. You have to understand a little bit about Kantian philosophy to really see where the argument fits. And I want to talk about that, but before I do, I want to talk briefly about the concept of the international and the fact that, take advantage of the fact that Kant is actually talking about this explicitly in ways that people generally haven't before this. So let me pause on this for a few minutes. See, there's a typical problem that one runs into within the study of political philosophy, which is mostly what we've been doing the last few weeks. And you run into this. There was a very famous essay by Martin White in the 1960s called "Why Is There No International Theory?" And what he meant was, why is there no political theory about international relations? Part of the reason for this, he diagnosed, and I think he's onto something here. A lot of people have thought he's onto something here, is that traditional political philosophy is about the relationship between the sovereign and the subject. So it presumes a border. It presumes a limit to the political community. It presumes that the important relations take place inside or domestically. Right, so traditional political philosophy is all about these sets of hierarchical relationships between subjects down on the bottom and then sovereigns up on the top in some way. And that simply does not look very much like what happens in international relations, for fairly obvious reasons. The major, most important one, obviously, being the fact that, by definition, the international is a realm without a sovereign. There is no sovereign of the world. There is no hierarchical world government. Even to the extent that we have universal international organizations, they are universal international organizations because they have many sovereign states as constitutive members. And, of course, sovereignty is the idea of being temporally supreme within your given geographical territory. So by definition, right, there is no sovereign when it comes to the international. And this lack of international sovereign, this lack of global sovereign, implies a whole lot of stuff, and people debate about the implications of it, and as we'll see and we have seen and will continue to see throughout the semester, a lot of international relations theory is about trying to figure out the implications of what it means not to have a global sovereign. But in terms of political philosophy, one of the things that it leads to pretty immediately is a lot of political philosophers are just not quite sure what to do with the realm of the international, right? Does the absence of a sovereign lead to some sort of chaos? Is it just pure random happenstance? Is that really all that's going on? If there's no sovereign to sort of keep everybody's inclinations and proclivities in check? So is the international just chaotic? Is the international some kind of ordered anarchy? I mean, anarchy just means the absence of government. It doesn't necessarily mean the absence of order. Is the international realm some kind of ordered anarchic environment? Again, very difficult for traditional political philosophy, especially in the European Enlightenment mode, to deal with, because, as we've seen, the main concern, the main obsession of traditional political philosophers is with the sovereign, and this relationship between the sovereign and political order. If there's no sovereign, what exactly do political philosophers have to say? So they have tended not to say very much about the international. Right? Or perhaps is the international realm just the rule of the strongest? Maybe there's no room for justice. Maybe there's no room for right. Maybe there's no room for legitimacy when it comes to international politics. Maybe international politics and international relations is nothing but the rule of the stronger, right? Law of the jungle kind of thing. It's a little unclear, and in what we've been reading so far, we've been seeing people grapple, they don't really grapple with it directly, it's sort of, it's out there, the international is floating around out there someplace. It doesn't have a huge front-loaded status. Now granted, part of that's kind of selection bias as to what I've chosen. I've not had us read Grotius, and I've not had us read Pufendorf, and I've not had us read some of the European Enlightenment thinkers who were actually very concerned about this exact question. And part of the reason I have not had us do that is because mostly what they're concerned about is they're concerned about international law. And that's a whole separate subset of issues to get into, this whole question about law and what law means. And the other reason I haven't had us do this, besides the sort of specificity of the domain of law, is that the model that they all have in mind is, again, this relationship of law and the sovereign. And so this is something that this illusion of law being related to the sovereign, the sovereign somehow being the origin of law or what underpins legitimate law, is something that they all continue to utilize. They make some slight modifications because of the lack of a global sovereign. So they'll say things like international law is when a bunch of sovereigns consent to something. But the basic terms of the puzzle that they're grappling with are still set by these domestic level political theories, which are about the relationship, hierarchical relationship between subjects and sovereigns, which is why I've chosen, one of the reasons I've chosen to really focus us on this as we're doing this particular course. So the international hasn't really been foregrounded in what we've read so far. Not that it's not there, right? I've mentioned a couple of times already, and we've had occasion to mention in class, that one of the things that theorists of international relations have done is they have done a state of nature mapping. They have taken an account of the state of nature out of one of the big classical political philosophers, and they kind of mapped it into the international. So the idea is that the international is like the state of nature in these philosophers, because the international, like the state of nature, is composed of a bunch of discrete autonomous individuals, just the individuals happen to be states when you're dealing with the international, and they don't have an overarching hierarchy, an overarching sovereign order within which to be located. And so that's where people get that idea from, saying, okay, well, if it looks like that, then that's kind of like what these folks were describing with the state of nature, so we can sort of use that as a way of talking about the international. There are problems with this, as I've suggested. Largely, the problems can be reduced to the basic suggestion that pulling the state of nature out of context from any of these folks really does a disservice, because then you lose the function of the state of nature within these very complicated political theories. So there must be other ways to do this. And in fact, there is. And one other way you can do this, one of the way people have done this, is by saying, okay, if the domestic realm ordered and constituted by the presence of a sovereign to rule over the subjects, if that is a realm in which we can have things like order and justice and rationality and so on and so forth, maybe if you don't have that, then all you get is not relations that are governed by order and justice and legitimacy, but relations that are governed by some kind of instrumentality. So maybe separately constituted sovereigns can only relate to one another on an instrumental basis. They can't do what subjects do when they mutually subordinate themselves to a sovereign, because that would create a hierarchy above them. So maybe if we're talking about multiple sovereigns, they can only treat each other in some sense instrumentally. Now, in Hobbes and Locke, we see some traces of this notion. Right? In both of them, we get the idea that because the sovereign represents, in some sense, the subjects and the interests of the subjects, then the sovereign can pursue their interests. The little line that Hobbes has about how the sovereigns have the interest of their people at heart, and therefore from the relations between sovereigns does not follow the same sort of problems as you get in dealing with relations between individuals and the state of nature. And for Locke, he says a little bit about commercial treaties and these sorts of things. And again, it's exactly the same idea. Because the sovereign, and this is typical for liberal sovereigns, right, but Hobbes and Locke say this very clearly, because the sovereign represents the subjects, and this, then the sovereign can pursue the interests of those subjects in dealing with relatively instrumental relations with other sovereigns. So sovereigns might team up with one another or might agree for something that would improve both of them. Right. In many ways, this is the origin of what grows up into being liberal IR theory, which we'll see a little bit later on in the semester. Now, this gets a little more complicated when you deal with someone like Rousseau, because one of the implications of Rousseau, right, one of the implications of a group of people getting together and having a general will is that the general will is only valid for the people who make it up. Because, again, the general will is what happens when the people are assembled as the sovereign. And so that's all of them together. Remember Rousseau's whole problem here. How do you find a form of government that keeps the natural liberty that everybody had in the state of nature? And in order for that to be the case, you would have to be a part of the general will articulation process. So there couldn't be any general will that would be bigger than that, because there would only be you, and you would have to be a piece of it in some ways. And so because each society has its own general will, one of the points that Rousseau makes doesn't stress this, but I think it's there, talks about how it becomes important for the general will to preserve the independence of the particular sovereign. So we're a group of people, we come together, we're going to rule over ourselves. We're going to end up not sacrificing any of our natural liberty because we come together as the sovereign to constitute ourselves in particular ways. And we go ahead and do that. Now, one way that our natural liberty could be infringed on is if somebody else comes in from outside and starts bossing people around or sort of imposes a government on us that we didn't actually choose in that moment when we were all assembled as the sovereign and therefore acting with the general will. So independence becomes important. Independence becomes constitutively important. You have to stay independent of other societies. Now, this doesn't rule out instrumental negotiations the way Hobbes and Locke have it. It does, however, perhaps make them a little bit more wary, and maybe the natural state here would be something more like individual societies with individual independent general wills kind of doing their own thing, going off in mutually independent directions rather than becoming enmeshed in certain kinds of instrumental agreements. The problem or the puzzle that all of this raises, which is a puzzle that is not classically posed within political theory, but is certainly a puzzle that the international poses, is the puzzle of global diversity. Because if we have two different societies, and in this society the general will says one thing, and in this society it says something else, well, what does that mean? Does that just mean, are we sort of forced into a kind of relativism? Can something be right here and wrong over there on the other side of the border? If we, the people, get together and decide that we're going to protect our property in a particular kind of way, or we're going to set up a certain kind of sovereign government over here, does that then, what happens, happens if other people do things differently? Is it possible that different societies could simply have reached different solutions? And if different societies have reached different solutions, then how do we know our solution's actually right? Maybe it's not. Maybe other people's solutions are better. So diversity becomes a problem when you start thinking in these terms. And the usual way that traditional classical political theory deals with this is by pushing diversity to the boundaries of the community. So the community as a whole somehow makes some kind of internal deliberation decision, and then something is binding for the community. And anything that was diverse, well, they become foreigners. They get pushed out. Either they never joined the particular social contract to begin with, or they get forcibly expelled in some cases, or they are just parts of an alien group that is somehow inhabiting the territory. There are a number of different ways of doing it, but the point is that for classical political theory, with its particular problem of order having to do with the establishment of a sovereign that rules over subjects, diversity and difference is sort of pushed to the boundaries. And when you start thinking about the international, all that diversity comes back, because all of a sudden all that diversity that was pushed to the boundaries or stuck over the border before is now staring you in the face, because now you've got a whole bunch of different communities doing a whole bunch of different things. And that gets really weird. And that becomes a puzzle or a problem. It's especially a problem if we switch from thinking about the international for a second and think a little bit more concretely about the Enlightenment, which we've been getting a handle on as we've progressed through this. There are reasons why the problem of global diversity is especially a problem for the Enlightenment, and particularly for the later Enlightenment, or what is sometimes called the Eastern Enlightenment. Let me just give you a little potted Enlightenment history here. We have been dealing with Hobbes and Locke, in particular, Rousseau's a weird marginal case for reasons we'll talk about in a second, with what is often called the Western Enlightenment. Sort of because geographically of where it begins is mostly France and Britain. In the Western Enlightenment, you have this notion, the primary notion is the notion of the subject, the notion of the individual, the rational individual that can be consent to her his own form of government, that can make scientific discoveries and so on and so forth. The subject, the rational subject, is primary within this phase or this chapter of the Enlightenment project. Experience and observation, as we've seen, are central. Right? The Western Enlightenment is very empiricist. Lots of people using their senses to discover stuff, trying to put things together. Reason becomes a way of calculating and combining stuff that you got through the senses. Right? So that's kind of how the Western Enlightenment works. Liberal individualism, as we've seen. Limited government. Governments are not actually allowed to do anything that they want to do. Even in Hobbes, where in some ways the person bearing the natural person bearing the artificial person of the Commonwealth, let's put this in direct, concrete Hobbesian language, that sovereign can do basically anything that sovereign wants, except that because that sovereign bears the person of the Commonwealth, then many of the things that person does will end up, according to Hobbes, actually being acts that help the people. And even then, the sovereign still has some limitations on what the sovereign cannot do. Besides being sort of accountable to God on the top end, the sovereign also can't order you to kill yourself. Right? So there are limitations on this. For Locke, there's more limitations. Government is more sharply limited in what it can do because you've got pre-existing property interests and so on. So this idea of limited government and government only by the consent of the governed and such, this is very much a Western Enlightenment idea. There is a trend here towards skeptical tolerance when it comes to questions of religion. So we doubt any claims to anything being incontrovertibly true, and we kind of tolerate stuff that we don't actually all know the answer to, as long as it's kind of politically demobilized. Because if it's politically mobilized, then it starts to infringe on sovereignty and break the polity apart. We're not so crazy about that. But as long as we're just talking about things that are, speculations about the hereafter and such, we're not really so sure about those things. So skeptical tolerance. You find this in one of Locke's more famous pieces, which we did not read for this class, but he has this letter concerning toleration, which is a very interesting account of how toleration works and why you should tolerate the diversity of religious beliefs. So that's kind of an emerging trend toward that. And in fact, even if you think about Hobbes, right, who's big on enforcing the conformity of public worship, even Hobbes is in favor of freedom of conscience, just not freedom of public action on that, or public worship. But in terms of what goes on inside your privacy of your own mind, Hobbes is no problem about that. And finally, in the Western Enlightenment, there's this idea that you have sort of the steady development of a single rational account of things, but it's a slow process. People are going to go out and discover stuff, they're going to overturn conventional wisdom, they're going to move on towards some kind of rational understanding of how things work. Then we have confidence in progress, we have confidence that this is going to happen. It's going to take a while, but we're getting there. We're getting there, we're moving past the ancients, and we're actually getting someplace that's rationally defensible. So that's the Western Enlightenment. Now, folks who talk a lot about the Enlightenment will often talk about a sort of second phase or intensification in what's sometimes called the Eastern Enlightenment, because many of the folks involved in this tend to be Germans, so it sort of moves over into Germany and Central Europe, which is where the main intellectual center of gravity for some of these thoughts go. And if the Western Enlightenment is mostly temporally located somewhere in the 17th century, Eastern Enlightenment kind of starts moving us into the 18th century a little bit, in and through the 18th century, and perhaps even on into the beginning of the 19th is where we get this kind of Eastern Enlightenment intensification. So, a couple differences, I think four differences between these two Enlightenments. And again, this is very schematic, but I think it's useful for helping to organize our thoughts about this a little bit. If in the Western Enlightenment we had primarily this notion of the rational subject, in the Eastern Enlightenment you end up with a primacy of reason. The most important thing is not individuality, but reason per se. Big capital R. Not just because the word is capitalized in German, but because reason becomes the big thing, right? The ultimate goal, the highest value is reason per se. Which is slightly different emphasis than what you got before. None of this reason is just the calculation of sense data stuff. It's much more sort of transcendentally mystical, in almost transcendentally mystical, in the way that it gets used in the Eastern Enlightenment. Reason has a certain kind of constitutive power that it doesn't always in people like Hobbes and Locke. The way that the Eastern Enlightenment tends to think about this when it comes to knowledge is, instead of reason being a way of calculating experience and or calculating from experience and creating some nice empirical generalizations or some good empirical findings out of this, instead the idea here was to subsume experience under different kinds of transcendental rational categories. So it becomes much more speculative, and the value of an argument is less its rootedness in experience, and more the ways in which it could be brought into a grand rational synthesis. So that is really the impetus for a lot of this later Enlightenment thinking. Government is not simply about being a limited protection of property or individuality. Government actually has a much higher calling within this style of thought. Government is about truth. Government is about the ethical. It's about producing an ethical life by conforming the civil law to the moral law. All right, so there's a much broader purpose in mind for these things than we've seen before. It's this idea that if we have reason and we can push reason further than just instrumental reason, that we can actually push reason into a much more speculative area and use that to ground some of these decisions that we might make about how to organize ourselves as a society. And therefore, we might be able to actually have, you know, living in conformity with law that happens to also be reasonable law brings us then closer, perhaps, to some sort of ethical life. And finally, instead of the idea that eventually we're going to have a fully rational account of things, but at least slow and painstakingly built over time, you end up in the Eastern Enlightenment with much more of an idea that everything, all of human history, we'll see this with Hegel, but you know, everything, Kant is pretty universal about this too, tends toward conformity with an absolute, which means that in some way, the progress that was so celebrated by the earlier parts of the Enlightenment gets in some ways radicalized. So progress is not just we know more, we can sort of figure things out rationally more rationally than we did previously. Instead, the trend is toward conformity with some absolute principle of reason. So progress is more than just accumulating facts. Progress is more than just accumulating know-how. Progress is bringing ourselves as human beings closer to some kind of rational perfection. Right? So that is kind of the impetus in this second phase of the Enlightenment. And if you know much about European philosophy as it developed during the 19th century, then you can certainly see where this is heading. And if you know anything about, say, Marxism, some of this may sound a little bit familiar, because there are ways in which Marxism very much picks up some of these notions. The idea that, in fact, what we do is the state is to produce a certain kind of ethical life, which then reconstructs people such that they conform, or such that we conform, to a higher set of ideals. Right? This is very much the kind of thing that a lot of, especially 19th century Marxist theorists, were very interested in doing. Because the idea is you could use the state to perfect individuals in some way, to make them as reasonable as possible. Very different than the liberal limited government tradition of the earlier part of the Enlightenment. So let me hit this distinction, and this is a very important distinction. And it's an important distinction because Kant and Hegel certainly fall on the second side, and Hobbes and Locke kind of fall on the first side of this particular historical division within the Enlightenment. But there is there's a progression, there's a pathway that moves from one to the other. In order to really understand how that happens, I think it's important to actually go into a couple of people to sort of see this. Before I do this, I want to talk about David Hume a little bit, and I want to talk a little bit about why Rousseau is kind of an interesting transitional figure between these two. I want to clear up a couple of misconceptions, what I'm not saying with this particular distinction, or what people are not saying with this distinction. The distinction between the Eastern and Western Enlightenments is not some sort of notion of modern democracy versus totalitarianism, which is how it sometimes gets satirized, because much like people would like to take Rousseau and draw a straight line to the French Revolution, there's an awful lot of taking Hegel and drawing a straight line between Hegel and Nazism. And that's really kind of complicated in a lot of ways. So this is not a distinction about modern democracy versus totalitarianism. I mean, for one thing, Hobbes, as we've seen, certainly isn't a democrat. So folks who are floating around in the early part of the Enlightenment are not necessarily pro-democracy in any recognizable modern sense. And Locke, as we've seen, doesn't have any kind of constitution. And we tend to think, when we think about modern democracy now, I mean, it would be almost impossible to imagine a complex industrial society governed by anything that was not constitutional. The closest we had, of course, was Britain for a while, which Britain didn't really have a written constitution, but it did have an accumulated set of things that had the weight and function, perhaps, of a constitution. But this distinction, this opposition, is not simply modern democracy versus totalitarianism. It's much more complicated than that. The other thing this is not is it is not a distinction between practical reality and idealism, which is the sort of thing that people in the Western side would tend to say about the Eastern side. They say, oh, speculative reason. Well, that's just silly idealism. Over here, we actually have practical things that are useful, and over there, they just have, like, abstract ideas or something. Well, first of all, as you've seen, if you've taken a look at pretty much any of Kant's stuff, but in particular, if you had a chance to look at that essay about what is enlightenment, you'll see that Kant really doesn't buy this distinction between practical reality and idealism. So Kant would not at all be happy to be hailed into that, and Hegel doesn't buy this particular opposition either. And as we've seen, Locke and Hobbes tend to have ideas about government which are not exactly straight reflections of practical reality either. So it's not just practicality versus idealism. There's something else going on here. Of course, we also have to be aware of the fact that, you know, we talked about this with Locke a little bit. We're in the United States. Even those of us that are not from the United States are kind of in it now, and are if we've been here for a number of years, we're sort of socialized into the kind of culture, or we've been acculturated to a certain kind of American individualism, which is to say that our system always seems more realistic to us. It's sort of the usual thing, right? Your own way of doing things generally seems like the way things are supposed to be done. Other people's ways of doing things just seem weird. So the distinction about practical reality versus idealism is almost always drawn by people who are skeptical of the idealism part, and they think that their own way of doing things is just more practical and more workable. Of course they do. It's their way of doing things. And that's something we always have to be a little skeptical of, that tendency even within ourselves. I think we need to be careful of that. As a number of anthropologists have pointed out, other people's religions are always weird. Your own religion is normal. It's other people's religions that are weird. And I think the same thing is probably the case when we're talking about political philosophy. Other people's political philosophies, other people's ways of organizing their government are strange. Our way is just the way things are. That's just the way things are, right? So we need to be careful of that particular tendency. Now, let me talk about this in slightly more historical terms, in slightly more concrete historical terms, using the example of a couple of particular people. Because there's a missing term here in the jump we've made from Rousseau to Kant, and the missing term is this gentleman right here, David Hume, who, if we had another several weeks in the semester, I mean, if there were more weeks in the semester, probably Hume would be one of the first, Hume might be the second person I would add to the syllabus. First person I'd add to the syllabus would probably be Nietzsche. The second person I would add would be David Hume. And I would add Hume because Hume is an amazingly important thinker in the latter part of the Western Enlightenment. So he's Scottish, he's doing a kind of Scottish and this sort of Scottish phase of the early part of the Enlightenment. And he's also an incredibly important person historically, because Kant really reacts against what he is having to say. And of course, Hume spawns a whole variety of philosophical followers within England and in other places, so he's obviously very important in his own right. And if this were a class about epistemology, we could then talk extensively about his account of causation and his skeptical view of knowledge and so on and so forth. But we're not going to do that, because we don't have 6 hours, and we don't have an entire another semester to do, you know, epistemology as it runs through all of these guys. Instead, a couple points about Hume, because he's an important bridge. And the main reason he's an important bridge is because for him, as for a number of the other sort of early skeptical Enlightenment folks, reason is not something transcendent that dignifies human action. Reason is the servant of the passions. So people have desires and interests and passions, and then reason is just a tool that gets used to act on and implement those things. What this means is that to the extent that there is moral imperative in the world, which Hume clearly thinks that there is, it must not come from reason, because reason is just the servant of the passions. Instead, the ground of morality must be natural sympathy. So the fact that we suffer internally when we see someone else suffering is the ground for Hume of a duty to care for others. Right, so natural sympathy. You can't just use reason to sort of get to this abstract idea of what your duty is supposed to be or what morality is at any given point. Instead, morality is supposed to be founded on natural sympathy. Government also comes out of these things. Government also comes out of a natural concord that people feel with each other. And then reason simply becomes a way of saying, okay, so how do we organize this stuff? So reason has kind of a subordinate place within this system. What constitutions are supposed to do is they keep governments in check. They preserve individual liberty. Right? Reason tells you that no matter how much you may feel akin to your fellow individuals in your community, that you still need breathing room, and you still have your own stuff. And so because of this, you need to have a government that will keep people relatively apart from each other and prevent the government from actually imposing itself upon you and taking away all of your stuff and destroying all of your natural liberties. So, constitutions preserve individual liberty. That's what they're supposed to do. Limited role, limited government. Hume is a big deal, very important thinker. Rousseau ends up really liking some of his stuff. He gets invited by Hume to go and hang out with him for a while. He does. And then he comes back and he writes some stuff that's a little bit different, kind of reacts to some of what he found in Hume. Rousseau is kind of a transitional figure in a lot of ways. See, for Rousseau, right, individuals do enter civil society in order to preserve their natural liberty, right? Individuals have natural liberty, and by getting together, they can coordinate, but they can coordinate in such a way that is not going to destroy that natural liberty. They preserve liberty. So it still sounds kind of like Hume or Hobbes or Locke, but the general will can force people to be free. And that's a hard notion to swallow if you're more of a liberal skeptic. Because why would the will of the group, not the will of all, not the sum of everybody's private wills, but the general will, why would even that be able to trump your individual interest and your individual sense of yourself? In fact, what is this general will stuff anyway? How is it that a bunch of people together can force somebody to do something, and that's not just an imposition on that takes away their natural liberty? So you can see in Rousseau that reason is already starting to take on something other than just a straight instrumental character. There's something different, something about reason can uniquely dignify particular sorts of courses of action or particular kinds of arrangements. That's new. See, reason for Rousseau does work through individuals, so individuals are still floating around and they're important and they have to engage in thinking about stuff, but not public deliberation. Right? Because they're not supposed to talk when they go in and do this determination of the general will. But for somehow, because individuals are all reasonable, reason seems to be able to get outside of them and exercise trans-individual compulsion. So individuals go to do stuff, but then somehow the general will can grab you and push you into doing other things. So reason isn't just limited by individuality. Reason can actually get outside of individuality and make individuals do stuff. That's different. There's something else going on in Rousseau that wasn't there in Locke and Hobbes. In that way, we might think of Rousseau as kind of the eastern edge of the Western Enlightenment. He pushes this notion about as far as it can go. He pushes this notion of individuals using their reason, but then somehow getting together to preserve natural liberty, and the strange paradoxes that comes up with, because then you can actually be compelled to do something that you didn't want to do, but paradoxically it could still actually be something that makes you freer. That's the kind of paradox that Rousseau poses, and that's what you get out here at the edge of the Western Enlightenment. And if we jump off the edge and keep going, then you find yourself with Immanuel Kant. And Kant is a very significant figure in all manner of things in philosophy, but in particular with respect to this, this kind of puzzle that was being posed by Rousseau. Right? How do individuals preserve their natural liberty? Well, Rousseau's answer was that you basically do it by self-legislation. You all get together and you all figure out what the constitutional things are going to be, and then once that's done, then you can't disagree with it because you already agreed to it, so there's no loss of liberty involved. Kant pushes this one step further, so it's not just will. For Kant, it's reason. It has to be reason alone that must ground politics, morality, etc. So people getting together, it's not that they will something that makes it that it doesn't compromise their natural liberty. It's that it's grounded on reason that it doesn't compromise their natural liberty. And the reason for that, of course, is because the dictates of universal reason are, of course, universally reasonable. Obeying the dictates of universal reason does not compromise your freedom and individuality. In fact, obeying the dictates of universal reason is perfect freedom. If I only do what is reasonable, and I am a reasonable person, then simply doing what is reasonable does not limit my freedom, according to Kant. It actually instantiates it. It actually fulfills my freedom. That's Kant's solution to this rather interesting puzzle. And when you start talking about this in terms of government, then the conclusion that Kant draws is that the state, far from being just something that keeps order, protects property or whatever, the state is a machine for producing an ethical life. The state is supposed to, as much as possible, set its decisions and its legal pronouncements on the basis of reason alone. And if it can do that, then obeying the state is not just obeying the dictates of some particular government, whether or not it is acting on the basis of some generally willed constitutional order. No, no, no. Obeying the state, if the state is close to reason, is more like acting in accord with ethics itself. So you can see the greater dignity associated with reason in this side of the Enlightenment. Now, a couple interesting things about Kant himself that might help to contextualize the stuff that we've read. One thing that you have to realize about Kant is that he lived and worked his entire life in authoritarian Prussia. There is a lively debate among Kant scholars how much of what Kant had to say was about the censors and how much of what Kant had to say was about Kant, particularly when it comes to politics. That maybe there's more going on here, that maybe Kant's celebration of a certain kind of political order has a lot to do with the fact that if he didn't celebrate that order, then he might not have been allowed to publish. Hegel, same kind of issue. But you do get the feeling, you get this with Hegel too, but you see this in Kant, that the celebration of authoritarianism is not entirely accidental to the celebration of reason. Because if you actually had the dictates of pure reason, then in order to impose that on people who might not necessarily have gotten it themselves, then you're going to need a certain amount of coercion and a certain amount of authoritarianism, because there's no need for you to actually be accountable to anybody else. So it's important to know that that's the world that Kant knows, and that's the kind of model that he seems to be referencing, both implicitly and explicitly. Also, perhaps important to know about Kant that he never traveled. He taught at the university in Königsberg, which is where he was born. I think he used to be said that he never left the town. I think he did leave the town, but he never went, certainly never went more than about 40 or 50 miles from where he was born. And that's important. That's important because Kant didn't think that valid knowledge was based on wide experience. Kant thought valid knowledge was based on systematic, rational reflection. And that was how Kant thought you could derive things. And this kind of is backed up or reinforced in the circumstances of his own life, where he's not a famous world traveler who somehow goes and sees lots of different things and draws conclusions from them. Instead, he sits in his study in Königsberg, and he reads everything that's ever been written, and he synthesizes it rationally, and comes up with his pronouncements that way. So that's the kind of person Kant was. Like Hobbes, but not like Locke, and not even really like Rousseau, Kant was a philosopher first and a political philosopher second. In fact, Kant is probably most famous outside of international relations circles for a book called The Critique of Pure Reason, which is what it sounds like. It's a book about pure reason and the circumstances under which pure reason operates. So Kant is probably most famous as a classical, sort of traditional philosopher who's interested in problems of knowledge and problems of mind and so on and so forth. His political philosophy is a derivation or an implication of his metaphysics and his epistemology. So for Kant, I mean, it's problematic to start with just Kant's political approaches, because you have to think about those as being related to this broader Kantian project. Now again, we don't have forever, so I'm not going to go entirely through it, but I do want to say just a little bit about this Kantian project, within which I think it is appropriate to situate Kant's more specifically political writings. So I'm going to do a little Kant 101, a little Kantian philosophy 101. The important thing that Kant is trying to do throughout all of his writings, no matter what he's writing about, is he's trying to come up with a transcendental ground for the truth of statements. This is particularly the case, and it's relevant to us here, particularly the case for ethical statements. He wants a ground that is transcendentally true. It's not grounded in empirics, not sort of shifty or contingent, but absolutely transcendentally true. Now, Kant is very bothered by Hume in this respect, because Hume, remember, right? Hume says morality is just about natural sentiment, right? Natural sympathy with each other. Kant's deeply troubled by this. He doesn't want to say that somehow our sense of what is right is nothing more than just a feeling that we have. He says, and even if that is, then we need to somehow get past our sense of what is right to find out what is actually right. So get past what we think, get past what we feel, get past what we might have been trained to believe as a child or something, and we should somehow get through that, get past the passions, get past these things that are empirical or accidental, and instead we should be able to get to the truth of what is actually good, what is actually right. That was what Kant was really trying to do. That's what he's concerned about. The transcendental part of this comes in the argumentative style that Kant has, again, throughout all of his writings. We have a claim which is sort of uncontrovertible or incontrovertibly true for Kant, a claim that just sort of makes sense. And then what he does is says, okay, what must be the case in order for this claim to be true? So what must be the case in order for me to be able to say that, that we should be pursuing peace? Right, that's in many ways the operative thing that's going on in the Perpetual Peace essay. In the Critique of Pure Reason, it's what must be the case in order for the propositions of Newtonian physics to be true. So we take something that we think is true, and then we kind of reason backwards. What must be the case? What must be the case in order for these things to be supported, to be defensible, to be rational? That's the realm of the transcendental that he likes to kick around in. And the main reason for doing this, especially when we're talking about ethics, is because if you could actually come up with transcendental rational grounds for ethical statements, then you would have something that was truly universal, that would apply to all rational beings. Right? He says, and this is in a different book, this is in the Grounding for the Metaphysics of Morals, which is another short book that's a bit of a head trip, makes this I'm just going to read this to you. This marvelous argument about the universality of what he's looking for. He says, unless we want to deny to the concept of morality all truth and all reference to a possible object, we cannot but admit that the moral law is of such widespread significance that it must hold not merely for men, but for all rational beings generally, and that it must be valid not merely under contingent conditions and with exceptions, but must be absolutely necessary. Right? That's the kind of grounding that Kant is looking for. Something that would actually apply to all reasonable beings qua reasonable beings, that would be universally binding and universally compelling on them. And then, the bet seems to be, or the argument seems to be for Kant, then you could say, okay, it's not just that we feel this is right. It's not just that we empirically have a sense that this particular course of action is correct. But no, we actually have this grounded on reason. We know this to be the case. Now, lest you think this is something odd, this is in many ways just an intensification of exactly the same thing as we've already seen in Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau, and if we'd read Hume, you'd see it in Hume as well. The idea that instead of simply founding what we think about in terms of government, in terms of founding the style of government that we have on tradition, we say, no. We might think this is true, but let's throw that out and let's actually start trying to build this back up from reason, from the ground of reasonable calculation. So what does reason tell us about how we should organize ourselves? Right? That's the sort of liberating moment in the Enlightenment, that there's reason breaking through things. Kant is just intensifying that and saying, well, we should get it to the point where we know for sure that it's just reason and not anything else. Because if there's other stuff junking up our reason and our calculation, we could still be wrong. We could still think we were right, but we could still actually be wrong because something other than reason might actually be driving our calculations and our thoughts. So the only way you can be sure is by getting rid of everything other than reason and founding yourself on pure reason alone. And that will tell you, at the end of the day, whether or not you are actually correct. Whether we're talking about science, whether we're talking about religion, whether we're talking about government. Now, in this case, of course, what we're talking mostly about is government. But that's the idea, that's the vision, that's the goal here, to ground everything on reason so you can be sure that you're absolutely correct about these things. Now, the individual reasoning subject is central to the way Kant does his whole philosophical turn, right? Individuals are supposed to use their reason to calculate these things, to arrive at these kinds of deductions and these derivations, to figure out what is actually going on. And Kant argued that, in fact, that's what philosophy was. Philosophy simply was the application of reason. And then you bring these things out and you have public demonstrations of them because then everybody can follow along, right? This is that argument in What is Enlightenment, that what's important about enlightenment is having discussion, allowing reason to be as free as possible. Right? You can see some of that in the Perpetual Peace essay, too. He has that line about how people should always be allowed to publish their dissent, and the philosopher should always be allowed to discuss things. Right? Part of the same basic idea, the individual reasoning subjects are really like where the action takes place. And the reason why the individual subject is so important to this is because, ultimately, and we're talking about politics, because of this notion of self-legislation, which is what you get, and you saw this in Rousseau already, but you see this even more in Kant. Because the rational subject subordinates itself to reason alone, doesn't do things based on custom or tradition, or doesn't do things out of fear, you know, doesn't do the right thing because it's afraid of being sent to hell or whatever. Instead, the rational subject does things because they are dictated by reason. So the rational subject has to be free to figure out what reason dictates. But reason doesn't dictate in some sort of idiosyncratic way just to some person per se. Reason dictates to all rational beings at the same time. Right? So if you are subordinating yourself to reason alone, then in a sense, you're not really giving up any freedom. You're not really losing anything, because the only thing you're subjecting yourself to is your own rational self and what reason demands. So this is like the general will on a universal scale, right? Because you can't really dissent. To dissent would be unreasonable. If universal reason dictates something for all reasonable beings, and you're a reasonable being, then you can't not go along with it. Sort of like the logic Rousseau uses, except instead of being bounded by a particular polity, we're bounded by nothing, just the sheer extent of reason and rational beings per se. Right? So it's like Rousseau on a huge scale, in some ways. In some ways. Not in all ways, but in some ways. Now, the ultimate goal of the Kantian project, which Kant wrestles with through many books, many things, is to try to ground individuality itself, the very existence of individuals, on reason rather than on intuition or empirics, so that you would, in fact, not have to even rely on observation of individuals in order to say, oh, there are individuals and they exist, but you could actually derive that from reason itself. That's the sort of big, big Kantian goal. Ground individuality itself on reason. Somehow show that reason per se dictates the autonomy of individual beings. Now, it turns out that Kant does not actually achieve this goal. Kant does not actually fulfill this particular project. He tries. He tries very, very hard. You have it through a lot of different avenues. But he never quite comes up with an incontrovertible proof that individuality is somehow dictated by reason alone. That's important. It's important that Kant doesn't succeed, at least in the big, big project. And the reason that's important is because, as we'll see in a couple of weeks, Hegel picks up the pieces of that project, historicizes them, and then pushes ahead with that agenda. So Kant doesn't actually get that. It's entirely possible that even though the big part, big goal of the project doesn't succeed, there may be other pieces that continue to have value, and that's something that we need to play around a little bit with. So a couple of questions as you make your way again through the text. Remember, I said you were going to have to read this more than once. Believe me, you're going to have to read this more than once. Kant is not the sort of thing you just kind of pick up 3 hours before class and go, oh yeah, I can skim this. No, no. Some authors are skimmable. Kant, not one of them. A few questions to ponder as you reread the Perpetual Peace essay. One of the things that's important is that Kant actually talks about IR, do his factual observations seem accurate? Does he have a good empirical grasp on how states relate to one another? Is he talking about international relations in a way that is recognizable to us as students of international relations? Is he right? Is Kant right in the various things that he proposes? What kind of evidence would possibly help you decide this? How would you be able to tell whether or not Kant were right? Well, that's, you know, it's a not insignificant issue. Can there actually be a theory of international relations? Right? Recall, we're talking about this at the beginning of the lecture, recall that for some theorists, the international, because it's outside of the dictates and domain of a sovereign, is just chaos. Maybe there can't be a theory of international relations. Maybe international relations is just a realm of pure contingency in which there's nothing that we can say about it intelligibly. So maybe there's no such thing as a theory of the international. Maybe the reason that most political theory is about domestic politics is because only domestic politics is where you can actually have theories. Maybe the very conditions of not having a sovereign at the global level mean there can't be theory at the international level. Or maybe if there is a theory at the international level, you have to ask yourself, would it in fact be a purely reasonable one? Now Kant seems to suggest that it can be. Kant seems to suggest that the operation of universal reason would not be stopped by the inconvenient fact of there not being a sovereign at the international level. He still seems to think that there are reasonable precepts that can be derived for the conduct of international politics. And because he's Kant, he ultimately wants these things to be grounded on pure reason, or reason that's as pure as possible. And something you need to ask yourself as you read this is, even if there was going to be a theory of international relations, would it be a purely reasonable one the way Kant seems to suggest? Or has he missed something important? On that note, I'm going to stop and let you get back to rereading the essay again.